Morning, everyone. All right, I'll have you turn to Ruth, chapter 4. We'll be covering verses 1 through 12 today. Ruth, chapter 4, verses 1 through 12. And as you're flipping there, I want you to have a question in mind. What do you think of when you hear the word determined? What do you think of when you hear the word determined? About a few months ago, I was scrolling through YouTube, which I normally do, and I came across a video that had a really interesting title and a caption. And it said something to the effect of some people are still up on Mount Everest. That's strange. I've been up there for years, and I said, all right. That intrigued me enough, so I was like, I'm going to check out what this video is about. So I looked at it, and a little bit more of it, I will tell you first off. But apparently there are people that, in an effort to either make it up the summit of Mount Everest or to come back down, didn't make it. And so their bodies are still preserved in ice and snow up on Mount Everest. As they were determined to try to make it up there, it cost them their lives. In a more recent example, we went to a arcade with our family while my sister-in-law was in town. And I realized that some people have a lot of determination to almost spend a whole paycheck on trying to get the claw machine, to get one of those prizes. Thankfully, we have a niece that is really talented at it, and she was able to get it and get all the stuffed animals. I think I've only won that one time, but people are really determined. They'll go there just with the intent of, okay, can I get the prize that I'm looking to get? In our life, what we'll find is, on more serious notes, there are competing goals that require our determination and our attention, right? We might have college in mind. Which college do I want to attend? Or we might have a house that we've seen that's up for sale that we want to buy. We're very determined. Maybe it's a desire to get married. And so it's a determination to find a spouse. And we have all these desires and ambitions that we are determined to accomplish. But what I want you to see in this text this morning is that it's not wrong to be determined. I think we should have determination. I think that's a God-given result of who he made us to be. But I think our determination should be modeled after, one, the character of Boaz, but secondly, and more importantly, after the example that Christ gave us. In this part of the book of Ruth, we witness Boaz in a place and in a time as a man on a mission, determined to secure the future for Naomi and Ruth at his personal expense. The willingness and determination of Boaz to act selflessly for the gain of others should model how we ought to live out our days, just as determined to help those in need at our personal expense, looking, again, ultimately to Christ as our chief example and whose image we bear as the church. So let's read chapter 4, verses 1 through 12. It says, now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the Redeemer, of whom Boaz had spoken, came by. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me, that I may know, for there is no one beside you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, the day that you buy the field from the land, from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead and his inheritance. Then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belongs to Elimelech, and all that belongs to Chilion, and all that belongs to Mahlon. Also Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." And all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." So the first thing we're going to look at this morning is Boaz, the determined redeemer. Boaz, the determined redeemer. I kind of want to set the stage, right? Because there's a lot happening. There's this court that's happening. They're buying and selling. Somebody's giving another person a sandal. So we have to try to kind of set the setting as far as what's taking place. So court is normally held in this day and age at the city gates. You can imagine a city that we have here. You have a wall that surrounds the city, and there's an opening. And there's two watchtowers on each side of the opening. And the watchtower would usually have the watchmen, and they would have other people as well. There would be rooms inside the towers that you can meet for this specific purpose. So it wasn't like going to the civil court or the library to have court. This is actually where court was held. There weren't only determined hours. You just showed up, and you presented your case, and the court was held at that time. And so, as we've seen in other parts of the book of Ruth, timing was left up to God, right? There are so many things that, by chance, took place at a certain time. But in this situation, providentially, it did have to happen, where Boaz comes to the city gates to hold his case, and he has to trust that this redeemer, this nearest kinsman redeemer, is happening to be going into the city or leaving the city to go farm. And so they bump into each other by chance. And so what you see here is a very determined Boaz. The last time we saw Ruth and Boaz was in the middle of the night, and she had asked, "Will you redeem me?" And he said, "Yes, I will make it happen right away." And so he goes to the city gates, and he's setting up everything, right? It's like when we're trying to set up for a kid's birthday party or set up for Christmas before the whole family. We're trying to get all the preparations set up in time before everybody arrives. And so you can see almost Boaz in the city gate, he's setting up chairs for everybody. And he's sitting down and he's waiting for this person, the right person, to come through so they can meet and they can have a council. And in this council, they have 10 elders that will witness everything that's taking place. And then naturally, as people are going about their business in the city or outside the city, they want to see what's going on. What's all the commotion about? And so that's why you have the witnesses that are taking place. And now it might seem strange to us because we might think, well, if Boaz is intent on marrying Ruth, why don't you just buy a ring and just propose to her? I mean, that's what we're used to in this day and age. You might ask the father of the daughter to marry her, but this was the custom in their day. As it talks about in the text, this was their custom in their nation. In order for Boaz to marry Ruth, which is really the aim here, he had to go through a set of legal proceedings regarding the land that Naomi and Ruth lived on. So we might be thinking, well, what is happening with the land? Why does Boaz need to purchase the land in order to ask for Ruth's hand in marriage? And we're not really sure why Naomi is selling land. We just know that she is. And somebody from the family has to redeem it. Well, we can kind of speculate as far as why she might be selling the land. Her husband has died. Her sons have died. So there's nobody else to take over the land in her immediate family. And I suspect that what she was getting from the gleaning that Ruth was doing in the fields of Boaz was not enough to sustain them both for a long period of time. And so similar to a story in Genesis, which we can read about in Genesis 47, there are people during the famine that would come to Joseph, and they would sell, they would have to sell their livestock. They would eventually have to sell their land just to get food. And so I suspect that's what's happening here, is that Naomi, in a kind of a desperate last thing we can do, is to sell the land that Elimelech left for them to the nearest redeemer to continue to live. And it must be sold to one of Elimelech's relatives who needs to buy the land so the land can remain in the clan and within the tribe. Therefore, the first right of refusal was for the family redeemer, not named in the story, to either purchase the land from Naomi or pass the responsibility onto the next person in line, which was Boaz, both of which were relatives of Elimelech, but we're not sure how close in proximity they were as relatives to Elimelech. Second thing we can look to and point to and say how determined Boaz was. Use a little gamesmanship, okay? He's strategically, he's scheming as far as how he's going to frame this situation to the Redeemer as they have court. So you can think of, imagine you go to a rummage sale and you eye something that you really want, that you know is really worth value, and somebody else has the same idea and they're looking at it and kind of getting over it. And you kind of want to draw them away from it and say, well, there's a little tear there, or there's something wrong with the card, that's not the right card. So that way, hoping to kind of turn that person off and saying, okay, well, maybe I don't want that. So then you can just hop in and grab it and take it with you and to buy it. Similar thing is happening here, except it's the way that Boaz frames the situation, right? He knows that there is a redeemer in front of him that has the first right of refusal to buy the land. And so what does he say? He says, this is the land. Naomi is selling the land. Do you want to buy it? The redeemer says, yes, I do want to buy it. And then he says, if you buy the land, you got to buy Ruth, the Moabite, right? The widow. Do you really want that? And so he's kind of framing it in a way that the guy says, well, I don't want to jeopardize my own inheritance. And so he says, okay, I'm not willing to buy it. If you want to buy it, you're the next in line. You can have it. And so he's using a little bit of a strategy here and a scheme as far as how he can have the right to redeem it from the first person. And what do we see in the story is that Boaz exemplifies selfless determination. So I'm going to dig a little technical into the law of Moses. The law of Moses stipulated that if a married man died without giving birth to a son who could inherit the family name and the family property, the man's brother was responsible for marrying the widow and conceiving a son for his deceased brother's behalf, of whom the son would not assume the name and inheritance of his biological father, but that of the deceased man's name and inheritance, to perpetuate the name of the deceased and to keep the land in the family, in the clan, and in the tribe. I understand that's a lot to take in, but it was a custom, basically, that the brother of the deceased person would marry then his widow to perpetuate the deceased man's name. And so what I'm going to have you do is keep one finger in Ruth chapter 4, but turn with me to Genesis 38. I think it helps to exemplify it in an illustration that we have back in Genesis 38. And I'm going to read the first 11 verses just to give you an idea that goes through this illustration right here for what we're looking at. In Genesis 38, it said, it happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Chezeb when she bore him. And Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord. The Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground so as to not give offspring to his brother. and what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up. For he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. And we'll cut it off there. But you also see this in the Gospels as well. So when these students are coming up to Jesus and they're talking about the practice is called levirate marriage. In Matthew chapter 22, verses 24, it says, Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. And so they're familiar with the custom as well. This levirate marriage must take place. So Boaz, though not the brother of Ruth's deceased husband, took it upon himself to extend the marriage offer to the widow and to the woman who didn't have children. The levirate marriage conditions were not fully met, and Boaz was not responsible to carry out the levirate marriage law. Boaz had in mind the spirit of the law in verse 10, to perpetuate the name of Mahlon, which was Ruth's deceased husband, so that his name would not be lost. And so here we see again Boaz going above and beyond the letter of the law and trying to advance the spirit of the law in this case. And Boaz did not have in mind anything for himself. Right? Before Ruth came on the scene, Boaz was a wealthy landowner. He had a farm. He had workers. Everybody respected him. He was well off socially and economically in that time and in that age and in that culture. So he saw something in Ruth that was precious to him. But Boaz was willing to pay a price to redeem Ruth, an act that truly, if we look at it circumstantially, profited Ruth more than it did himself. Boaz assumed the price. He had to pay for the land, and he had to pay for redeemed Ruth as well. So he had to pay out of his personal expense to pay for her. Boaz assumed the price because he secured what was precious to him. And finally, for Boaz, what we see is that he receives blessings for his redemption. So our story in this case closes in Ruth chapter 4, and we see the witnesses and everybody, right? They come around, the town people come around, they bless Boaz for what he has done. And they allude to two sets of people. They allude to Rachel and Leah, right, who are responsible for bringing about the 12 sons that will eventually lead to the 12 tribes of Israel. That nation as a whole is in view. Then we head back to Genesis 38, where we just were, and the story of Judah and Tamar, which led to the birth of Perez, who was mainly responsible for the growth of the tribe of Judah. And so you're going from general to specific. And now Elimelech and Boaz are a part of that tribe of Judah. The blessings were from general, again, general from specific, from the national level to the tribal level. The blessings are extensive, and they're meant to convey a sense of significant growth, right? They want this blessing, they want this household to grow, both in number and in reputation within the household of Boaz. Now, what is significant in the text, what's actually picked up in the original language, is that this other character, the redeemer, the family redeemer, doesn't have a name. He's not specified by his name. And actually, it talks about the way to translate is Mr. So-and-so. And so it's almost like insignificance. What did this guy have in mind? He had in mind his own inheritance, right? When he knew that his reputation could also be troubled, if he took for the wife a Moabite and a widow, that could also tarnish his image as well, and his inheritance was in jeopardy. And so his interests were for him and for his own. This is contrast to Boaz. So we have Mr. So-and-so, and we have Boaz. As the court plays out, it becomes evident that the family redeemer has, at one level, his own interests in mind. Verse 6, in particular, shares with us that the redeemer's rationale as to why he did not want to redeem the land was because it could impact his own inheritance. Contrast this with Boaz, who is going out of his way to redeem the land and to marry Ruth at his own expense. What happens as a result? What happens as a result? Well, we see that the redeemer steps off the stage with history. Out of the spotlight, desiring to protect his own nest egg, even if it means that his name is lost forever and his role in God's redemption plan is gone. Just as we saw earlier in the book of Ruth, right? Ruth wasn't the only daughter-in-law. There was Orpah, right? And when there was that decision to be made, right, when Naomi looks back and says, are you guys going to follow me back into Israel? You have better opportunities for yourself to go back to your mother's house in Moab. What does Orpah do? She says, okay, I'll go back to my mother's house in Moab. Ruth continues on. And so what we see is that in this book, years and years, thousands and thousands of years later, whose name is still what we read about. We read about Boaz, we read about Ruth. We don't even know the name of the Redeemer. We don't know the name of Orpah beyond that she was married to one of Naomi's sons. And so because they had their own interests in mind, because they wanted to take care of themselves and their family, which is not always a bad thing, but in this case, they have decided, yes, I want to keep my inheritance intact, or I want to protect my progeny, that I am going to stay away from Naomi, and I'm going to stay away from Ruth. The names of those whose interest was first on theirs and their own were removed from the books of history and removed from God's story. Now, the second thing, as we look at the story, what I want you to see is that there's some parallels, there's some points of contact. The second main point that we're going to look at is Christ is the great Redeemer. Christ is the great Redeemer. So if our first point is Boaz, the determined Redeemer, we have Christ, the great Redeemer. And as the story points out to us, and what we should be aware of, is that this is a type. This is a type in the Old Testament. What is a type? A type is a historical person, or it's an event that points to Christ. And so when Christ is on the road to Emmaus with his disciples, he's saying that the Old Testament points to me. He's pointing to the types that occurred inside of the Old Testament. Boaz is a type of Christ in the Old Testament. This redemption is a type of redemption that was to later come with the fulfillment of Christ. So you can think of the ram, right, there in Isaac's sacrifice was a type for Christ to come. The manna from heaven. Jesus calls himself the bread from heaven. And so a type, examples again include the bronze serpent in the wilderness. So when you read about John 3:16, he prefaces with the snake that was lifted up in the wilderness. Just as the snake was lifted up, so the Son of Man should be lifted up as well. So we have to keep those types in mind. This is a type that foreshadows what was to come in the New Testament. Moses, Joseph, King David, all types, all point to the greater version of themselves in the New Testament. And our redemption is foreshadowed in this story. Just as Ruth and Naomi's future were in the balance, and really they were helpless, there was nothing that they could contribute to the negotiations that their destiny would be fully dependent on the work of Boaz, so too is the bride of Christ, the church. Though it is our destiny that hangs in the balance, there is nothing we could do to change where we are headed aside from what Christ did on our behalf. And just like Boaz, as there were items to take care of, including the redemption of the land to marry Ruth, there is a lot that had to be done, right, to redeem the bride of Christ, including the forgiveness of sin, which had to be dealt with on the cross. And we can see throughout the Gospels that Christ was determined to redeem his bride. From the incarnation to the public ministry where Jesus is baptized and then right away he's sent into the wilderness, right, to be tempted by the devil, we constantly see in the Gospels this moving forward, this advancing forward. When his disciples try to stop him and say, you can't be crucified, you can't go to Jerusalem to be crucified, he says, no, that is what I need to do. There's a determination. In the Gospel of John, what we see is that even in the garden, when the guards approach him, and then Jesus says, he says his words and they fall to the ground, right? He says, you don't lay my life out. I lay it down on my own accord. And so there is a determination, there's an urgency and a certainty in the Gospels that we see that plays out, that Jesus is setting everything up in order as it should be in order to redeem his bride. And what do we know about Christ? We know that Christ had nothing to gain by going to the cross for the sake of his bride. Christ is determined to save the lost, to redeem those from whom he has nothing to gain. He is God the Son, and he doesn't need us. Yet he did the ultimate selfless act of going to the cross to save us. And we read about the marriage supper of the Lamb that is to come yet, where he will marry his bride. This does not make him whole or complete. Outside of history and outside of time, we have the triune God, right? They don't need us to complete them. He has always been complete and whole. And yet he took it upon himself to pay the price for the sake of his bride, the church, and for the sake of the saints of old who believed in the promises of God, including Boaz and including Ruth. And that's where we can talk about here is Boaz. It's easy whenever we read a story or we watch a movie, we have the hero in mind. And clearly, in this case, what we see in specifically in chapter 4, who is the hero? The hero is Boaz. Right? He's going about selfless expense to rescue Ruth. But it would be unwise for us to walk away from this story and to suggest that Boaz is the hero and miss what Boaz undoubtedly recognized, that he needed a redeemer. His personal story was highlighted by the Exodus story. I have to remember that at the end of the day, he's an Israelite. And so they would have known each year as they celebrated the Passover who really redeemed them. Why did Boaz act in this way? Why is he acting in this selfless way? Because he understood what God did for him and his family. And they were slaves in Egypt. And he purchased, and God purchased them out of slavery and brought them and redeemed them. He's pulling from that. He understands that God is his redeemer. And throughout, you see a sprinkling throughout the Old Testament of how Israel alludes to God as their redeemer. Boaz knew that his helplessness and his sin and his need for God as a redeemer drove him to be merciful and gracious to those in need. For it is only those who recognize their own need for help that in turn recognize the role and desire to help others in need. Though Boaz is viewed here as the hero, the one following through with the request of Ruth and making good on his promise to acquire the right to redeem the land and marry her, Boaz, too, must ultimately acknowledge his helplessness. The Redeemer must recognize his need for a Redeemer. One thing we have to remember is that the hero of any story, of any ministry, is still a lost sinner without the redemption of Christ. We all rely on the Redeemer. And just like Boaz, as we see at the end of our passage here, we see the blessings that are coming from the calling people that are blessing Boaz and saying, we want your household to be made great. What do we know about Christ? Skip forward to the New Testament, and what do we see? Is that Christ's name will be praised for eternity. His name is praised now, it's worship now, and it will go on. And while we have the opportunity, as we do in church each Sunday, to praise his name, we will continue to praise his name. And we will bless his name by praising him. Until we see a greater blessing for Christ, for his bride. The third thing I want to look at is our responsibility, determined to grow. Because in this situation, we can look at it and we can say, okay, that's great, Adam. We have Boaz who is redeeming. He's redeeming for a family relative. We have Christ that's redeeming, right, for the sins of man, to redeem them back to himself, to give them life. What's our role in this story? What do we take away from this? You know, as a little kid, the only thing I could think of as far as what I redeemed were these savings certificates that I got from my grandpa each birthday. So eventually I got enough of them, I took them to the bank, and I redeemed them, right? So we can think of, okay, what is the only thing that we do in life is we redeem savings certificates. We're not responsible for being a kinsman redeemer. We're not redeeming anybody from and buying their land so that they can survive. And again, we're not Christ, and we're not playing the great redeemer. But our responsibility plays out in the blessings of Christ. Christ has established his household in the church. And our responsibility is that we want to see the household of God grow. We should not just desire this with our words as we sing out and we praise his name, but our desire, again, should be that we see growth within the household of God. So the first thing There's a number of ways that this happens. Is numerically, as a church we grow. How does that happen? How do we grow numerically as a church? Right? God saves sinners, yes, but how does he use us to save sinners? We share the gospel. Now, I'm not asking everybody in the room to be on the street corner at the state fair to be proclaiming the gospel to everybody. Or outside Lambeau Field, right, where the Packer game is about to happen, and there's somebody that is doing street preaching and sharing the gospel at that venue. But more on a basic, more on a personal level, do you have the opportunity to share the gospel with our coworkers, with our bosses, with our roommates, with our classmates, with our patients, with our clients, with our parents, siblings, and children? It doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be complicated, and it doesn't have to be on a grand level. But a love for those that are close to us, who want to be saved by the good news of God's gracious gift of life, through personal evangelism. Share the gospel when you have the opportunity, and pray to God that he would open those doors to share the gospel with both of them. Second way we do that is ministry opportunities. If we see God's household grow, if we see Christ's household and church grow, we should be eager to fill in ministry opportunities where we can, because a growing congregation requires more workers, more laborers, right? And this church is great at it. Everywhere I go, I see different people filling in different roles well. Not only does it satisfy a logistical element of it, right? We need musicians, we need security, we need people to look at kids, we need coffee to keep us awake. There is a need and a desire to use our spiritual gifts. God has saved us, not by good works, but for good works. And he's equipped us with spiritual gifts to serve in the church. And I appreciate when I see people who can minister to me as well, who share their spiritual gifts, just as I need them. And so as we have ministry opportunities to serve a growing church, I would ask you to pray about where is God asking you to serve and to minister to others. Third thing is we partner with missionaries. This could be local and global, right? We're getting ready to send out our first missionary to Malaysia. But I think we have to think about what are some other opportunities to partner with missionaries. There will be other missionaries that will come. They'll present their case as far as where they're going to share the gospel with. We have the opportunity to come alongside them with our prayers, with our funds to help support them, and encouragement to make sure that the word of God goes out to different countries so that the gospel is shared in different areas. But this is globally, yes, but also locally as well. We want to make sure that we're taking care of those within our local area as well. So three things again: personal evangelism, ministry opportunities, and partnering with missionaries. Second thing we want to look at is we should be determined to personally grow into the image of Christ. Personally grow into the image of Christ. How does this take place? It's not something that's just going to happen naturally. And it certainly isn't going to happen because we wake up in the morning and decide, yeah, I feel like this is what I want to do. There's going to be a flesh component that's going to fight against us, right? And so we have quiet times and discipleship are two avenues that we should pursue on an ongoing basis as a way to grow in our knowledge of God and our love of God, and really to form our desires within our heart that we want to serve God. This requires time investing in our Bibles, in prayer, in discipleship. I would say there are two relationships that you should have in your life. One person that should be discipling you, and one person that you're discipling. I think that's how we grow, is in our Bibles, in our prayer, and with discipleship. The Great Commission talks about not just sharing the gospel, but discipling others, raising them up and teaching the things that Jesus has taught them. And what this might come to is a cost of our own pastimes. Things that occupy our time and our attention, and frankly our desires, that can pull us away from those areas. Like, I don't want to read my Bible because, you know, I'm just too tired, or I want something else that's, it's, you know, I'm just going through YouTube. That I just want to do something else other than trying to grow in the Word of God. We need to be mindful. Leisure is not bad. But I think if it comes at the expense of spending time with God, then it becomes problematic. And so we need to make sure we carve a set time out each day, that we're spending time in communion and fellowship with God, and that we're growing the fellowship of the saints with each other through discipleship. Second thing is, we never want to be satisfied with our growth, right? We look at and we take an honest assessment of where we're at. Are we the same Christian that we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Have we grown? Have we developed? Have we matured? Paul talks about this in the letters to the Corinthians, right? Where he's saying, I wish I could come to you and give you solid meat, but I still have to give you milk. Why haven't you grown? Where is the growth? Where is the maturity that's taking place? And just like a child grows to an adult, we should never be satisfied with the growth that we're at. And just as a child wants to become an adult, right? We should never be satisfied with the growth that we're at. We should examine where in our lives we're actively seeking to pay the price for the benefit of others. That selfless determination, especially those who don't have the means of paying back, and without the motivation of monetary or social gain for ourselves. Last thing is, we need to determine to leave worldly ambitions and cleave to Christ. If we're talking about this imagery of marriage, right, we have this idea of leaving and cleaving. Leaving worldly ambitions and cleaving to Christ. That involves making our story less about us and more about others. We talk here in the text in Ruth 4 about perpetuating the name. What name are you trying to perpetuate? Which name are you trying to platform? Is it your own name? Is it your own platform that you're trying to perpetuate? Or is it the name of Christ? We all have a role in that. We all can be part of the history of the church that is going on because Christ said he will build his church. The Apostle Paul talks about this. How he pours his life out as a drink offering to the sacrifice for the church. In 1 Corinthians 11, we read about the Lord's Supper, how you consider yourself, the rich consider themselves less than the poor so that they would wait for them so they could share a fellowship meal together. Our story is less about us and more about Christ. And finally, we should lift high the name of Jesus. We have the opportunity again to not make our name great above Christ, but we have the opportunity to become part of someone else's story and to keep the tradition of faith alive. As we were talking about chartering last week, right? We got a chocolate cake. We put Roger on the spot here. I was ready for it, but he had mentioned it would be appropriate to have 2,000 candles on there, right? Because the birth of the church, right, started after Pentecost, and he's right. We have the shoulders of giants that we are going on, right? It is Christ's church, but we all play our part in lifting high the name of Jesus. We have the opportunity of ministering to lift high the name of Jesus, 2,000 plus years in the process. Our gratitude is what fuels that, right? Ruth and Naomi were helpless in the situation. Yes, their destiny was at stake, but they were helpless as far as what they could do to make sure that it happened as it happened. And so certainly they had gratitude toward Boaz for what he did. Our gratitude, our helplessness should be a good reminder that what we do for Christ is because of what he first did for us. That should fuel us. Unable to redeem ourselves from sin's curse, we can only cry helplessly out to the one who is mighty to save. And our response is that of thankfulness and a willingness to do whatever he asks. So in closing, while it's a great story of Boaz's determination to take it upon himself to save Naomi and Ruth, we need to examine where it is that we still find ourselves slipping into selfish tendencies. Where do we look first to our own interests or to our own gain, to personal comfort and to entertainment at the expense of neglecting the needs of others? Perhaps the needs aren't as apparent as we first recognize on the outside. Perhaps the need of someone else is to be known, to be listened to have company and to have fellowship with one another. Who are those in your life that could use your help? Who would appreciate your company? Who in your life still needs to hear the gospel, even if it means feeling uncomfortable and initiating a hard conversation? Who feels a burden from the Lord to serve in a ministry at church? If you take inventory of your own life and ask yourself, I am determined to blank, what will you fill that blank in with?